boogie till the break of day. Let the man come and take me away. Sitting on the bench down the park, talk to myself alone in the dark, saying,
boogie,
oh, rock that boogie,
boogie,
come on, rock that boogie, rock that boogie till the break of day. Let the man come and take me away. Rock that boogie.
That's Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen with Rock That Boogie. Before that, the Marshall Tucker Band. I know, sorry. It's probably not what we usually play here, but pretty good song from their debut album, Take the Highway. And we start that set off with Little Feet and Spanish Moon. I think that's just going to about do it here for Breakfast for Dinner. This is DJ Chris Wired. I want to thank you for listening. All things working out, should be back next week with more music. Anyway, in honor and respect for the passing away of Robbie Robertson, we'll play a song from the band off their self-titled album, The Band, Look Out Cleveland. Thanks for listening. This is WRCT Pittsburgh.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
Well, my initial thought was, especially because this was such an iconic, important story, and these people actually exist, and the family of these people are still alive, that I was honored that they came to me to portray this role, this very important role in this extremely important piece, well written, you know, beautifully casted. And the producers and directors are all top-notch. And that they came to me to portray this man was a gravity that I did not take lightly as portraying, and wanted to make sure that I got it right, you know. And so the Wheeler family, which was one of the nephews, saw the piece, and we were all on a Zoom, and it meant the world to me to have the family, led by Mr. Wheeler, say that I got his uncle right, you know, that I got the part, that I did him justice.
Glenn Turman, Emmy Award-winning actor, writer, director, and producer. Turman is coming off an incredible year with buzzworthy performances in Netflix's Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and a Critics' Choice nominated role in FX's Fargo, and he stars in ABC's Jay-Z and Will Smith produced Women of the Movement as Mose Wright, a real-life civil rights movement leader and great uncle to Emmett Till. The New York City-born actor enjoyed his first real taste of acting success as a young teenager, originating the role of Travis Younger on Broadway in the landmark play A Raisin in the Sun opposite Sidney Poitier and Ruby Dee. Upon graduation from the renowned High School of Performing Arts in the city, he apprenticed in regional and repertory companies throughout the country until he landed in Los Angeles in the mid-1970s. Turman has also appeared in some of the most iconic films and television series, including Cooley High, A Different World, The Wire, and Queen Sugar. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, noted Emmy Award-winning actor Glenn Turman in Black America.
Well, what's to say? You know, DeVito is one of my favorite characters, you know, in some of the pieces that I played. Again, another, you know, blessing to be a part of a piece like that, you know, and with a cast that's so great, you know. And I had played Toledo at the Mark Taker Forum here in Los Angeles.
Okay.
In a stage production where Denzel came back and said, "Hey, Glenn, you know, we're going to do this as a movie, and so I want you to stand by." And then a year and a half later, he came back and fulfilled his promise there. And we went into production in Pittsburgh, using Pittsburgh as Chicago for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
The talented Glenn Turman, whose 60-year career including appearing on Peyton Place, The Mod Squad, Hawaii 5-0, Palmerstown, USA, The Twilight Zone, and Murder, She Wrote, just to name a few. His film credits just as impressive. They include Thomasine and Bushrod, J.D.'s Revenge, Gremlins, How Stella Got Her Groove Back, and The Obama Effect. Turman is also an award-winning stage and television director, directing episodes of Hanging with Mr. Cooper and the Wayans Brothers. He also directed during his seasons of acting work in A Different World. He's also the newest face of Beyoncé's Ivy Park denim line. In his latest performance, he plays the role of Mose Wright, the great uncle of Emmett Till, who invited him to spend the summer in Money, Mississippi. Women of the Movement is the story of Mamie Till Mobley, who sought justice for her son Emmett following his brutal murder in 1955. Till's story continues to reverberate 6 years later as the nation continues to grapple with senseless race-based murders. Recently, In Black America spoke with Glenn Turman.
Mama decided to move down to Greenwich Village in the late 50s, early 60s. We were in the Greenwich Village. She was a free thinker, and the Greenwich Village was known for its progressive attitude, and she moved down there into an enclave of like-minded people who were artists and, poets and writers and jazz musicians and so on and so forth, and that's where I grew up.
I heard that. I understand that you wanted to be a baseball player?
I did. It was Jackie Robinson, man. Every kid in my era wanted to be Jackie Robinson. So, yeah, that's right.
And I understand that you used to kind of skip school every day and really wasn't into education?
Well, I would skip school when I could, and if I thought I couldn't get caught, wouldn't get caught. they used to have truant officers out looking for you back in those days. But I was a chronic truant, yeah, absolutely.
And understand they say it's not what you know, is who you know.
Your
entry into entertainment was with the Lorraine Hansberry play, Raisin in the Sun. You played Travis with the late Sidney Poitier?
That's right. That's right. That was my entree into the show business world.
How did you get the role?
Well, it's not who you know. It's not who you know. It's who knows you.
Okay.
All right. And who knew me was Lorraine Hansberry, mm-hmm. the author of the play. She knew me because she used to see me running around the streets there in the West Village, and she was a friend of my mother's, and she used to see me playing up and down the street, playing baseball, stickball. We used to play a lot of stickball back in New York, and she said, do you think Glenn would be interested in trying out for the play? I tried out, got the part, and here I am.
Glenn, I understand you were married at a young age? 18?
Yes, I was. Yes, I was. Married my childhood sweetheart. My school, well, not my childhood, my high school sweetheart is what you say, yeah.
Okay, and when did you decide to really take acting serious?
When I got to the high school performing arts, I took it serious. I had already been on Broadway, but performing arts high school was a very challenging place for me. It was a difficult place to get into back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And I was accepted. And once accepted, I accelerated and did well. And I never played hooky again. And because they were teaching me how to act, and they had acting classes and dance classes and music classes and all these kinds of artsy kinds of things that were a lot of fun. So, half of the day was spent in what we called shop.
Mm-hmm.
The other half was spent in the academia world. But to stay in the shop world, you had to pass at least some of your academics. So I did enough to pass and not get kicked out of school because I didn't want to miss my shop classes.
I understand you were a truck driver for a furniture company.
Yeah.
And you heard about an audition that was happening that day, and you took the truck with the furniture and the...
Where you getting all this info from, man? You read my biography?
Well, we try to do our homework around here. So tell our audience about that story.
Well, it's a story. I guess I've told enough for it to get out. I had many jobs that I'd gotten fired from,
Mm-hmm.
I got fired from most of my jobs that I had that were 9-to-5s, and, from Macy's to Gimbel's to the Diamond District to United Artists in the mail room. And finally, I landed a job as a truck driver, furniture mover, and what was cool about it was, I could take off sometimes and go for auditions, and they wouldn't fire me. Boss wouldn't fire me. But this time, I had a truckload of furniture and a crew, and I was reading the backstage casting ads, and I turned the whole truck around with the furniture and everything in it and the crew and just headed for the audition. The audition was for Mr. Lloyd Richards, who had been my first director in the play Raisin in the Sun, and I auditioned for him with that truckload of furniture sitting on the sidewalk downstairs, and I got the part, and so it was a milestone in my career there, to say the least.
Talk to us about your experience with the Inner City Theater.
Inner City, Inner City Culture Center was the company that brought me to California to be in a play called Slow Dance on the Killing Ground, which was a William Hanley play. Now, I had been in plays in New York at the American Place Theater with Win Hanman, the great Win Hanman, and I was about to do another play for him at the American Place Theater when I got a call from the wonderful Vinette Carroll to come to New York, to come to California and be her Randall in Slow Dance on the Killing Ground. So I went and was supposed to be here just for the few months that the play was going to run. And that was 50-something years ago. I'm still here.
When did you decide to move to Los Angeles?
Right then. When I left New York, it was 3 degrees below zero. It was January 17th. And when I got off the plane later that same day, it was 76 degrees, just like it is today. I made up my mind right then. I wasn't going back to New York.
How did you go about landing a job with Gregory Peck on Peyton Place?
Well, Gregory Peck came and saw that play that I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And when he saw me in the play in that role, he suggested that, he brought producers from the play, from the TV series down, had them come down and see the play and see me in it. And they said, yeah, we've got to have Terman in this role. And they reunited me with the wonderful Ruby Dee and the great, the beautiful Judy Pace and Percy Rodriguez, and we became the Black family of Peyton Place, which was the big nighttime series for TV back in those days.
You are an iconic actor and notable with your portrayal of Peach in Cooley High that they play kind of regularly down here. How'd you go about getting that role?
Well, I got the role of Preach because I had done a play with Michael Schultz, and he was directing. He was going to direct Cooley High, and I also knew Eric Monty. I didn't want to take
right.
Him. And so those all that just kind of lined up, and they went in pretty strong with me in mind for the character when they went to the studios and said, this is who we want, you know. And the studios didn't fight back, so I ended up with that role.
Are you surprised with the longevity of Cooley High?
I am. I am surprised, you know. And we just got into the National Film Registry,
right.
You know. And, boy, I'm, you know, we're doing that play, that movie. We never thought that it would take on and become the iconic film that it has become, you know. But I'm certainly glad that it did.
It was a life changer for many of us.
You're currently playing Mo Wright
in the
miniseries
Life of
Emmett Till. How did you go about
the miniseries? The women of the movement.
Right,
so,
right.
The women of the movement. It's the life story of Emmett Till told from the mother's point of view. Maybe Till Mobley. She is played by the wonderful movie for Warren. Warren won the Tony Award for the Chino on Broadway. And so I play Mo's Wright, who was the boy's uncle. Till's uncle was farmhouse Emmett Till out of on that fateful night.
What was your initial impression when I had a chance to read the script?
Saw the piece, and we were all on a Zoom, and it went the world, and had to have. that I got his uncle right, you know, and I got the party that I did him justice. And that meant the world to me, absolutely.
Well, when I saw that, because there's also a first and second person series after the dramatization.
Yes, like the
likeness.
Yes.
Moe's right side being slender, and it was just uncanny. Talking about the movement.
Where were you able to find the house?
I was particularly enamored with the push button light switch. I hadn't seen those in I don't know how long.
And the other thing was, you all had to finish it, or you all just gave the rest of it to the crew.
When the series opened in the first episode,
you all were sitting down at dinner.
So were you able to find that particular house in Chicago, or was that set built for the series?
No, we found that house. Okay, because I'm kind of a set kind of person.
I look at that also.
Talk to us about playing Toledo and Miami's Black Box. Leader and so this is a piece that's for
Obama's Higher Ground Induction Induction Company.
Mrs. Obama.
Had fallen in the show business with a production company that's in the region. This is their flagship production.
And I'm just
blessed and honored to be a part of their
first
Hispanic bat
with a drama, you know,
out of Higher Ground Productions.
Couple more questions. Once upon a time, you were a Hollywood hit couple with Aretha Franklin.
That's right.
How did you all meet?
We met at a concert that she was at.
She was performing at,
and I met her backstage. Was introduced to her. I have a son. She was a big fan. Holly Hyatt had just been out. She was a big Holly Hyatt fan and Berlin Turian fan. And
of course, I was a regular Aretha Franklin fan.
And we met backstage. She came to my student.
I was teaching
at that time that we talked about earlier, the Inner City Culture Center.
And she came and studied with me for a short time.
And we began dating.
And not too long
after that, we had denied.
How does a young man from Greenwich Village, Harlem, become an experienced horseman?
Coretta King.
Suggestions after future In Black America programs,
email us at
inblackamerica@kut.org.
Also let us know
what radio station you heard us over.
Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
You can hear previous programs online at kut.org.
Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs
at American Archive of Public Broadcasting.
That's AmericanArchives.org.
The views and opinions expressed on this program
are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin.
Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez.
I'm Johnny Johansen Jr.
Thank you for joining us today.
Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs. KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs. KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio. University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
Black women know that if we don't do anything else, just going up with our whole selves, it is radical resistance. worthy. I want men to walk away from this conversation. After reading this book, I want them to feel even more excited about co-creating spaces for us to be, together. And feel like they have heard me celebrate blackness in general, which is including, black and brown women, right? And so not including them, but focus on black women. So I want black women first, black men to see this as an opportunity for them to learn more about how we want to do justice work moving forward and how they can help us to make that reality. And I want all people who are not black to read this book and to walk away feeling like they have especially considered themselves allies to black women.
Ebony Janice Moore, founder and CEO of the Free People Project, the Ebony Janice Project, and author of All Black Girls Are Activists, A Fourth Way Woman Pursuing Dreams as Radical Resistance, published by Row House Publishing. During the book, All Black Girls Are Hacking More Ads in an attempt to offer some answers to thought-provoking questions, naming black women wellness, wholeness, and survival as the radical revolution they have been waiting for. Also, she offers language to help African women understand their social, political, and spiritual religious location in society, provide tangible ideology and tools to support them in co-creating realities for that wholeness and wellness. These love letters, 2 years in the making, address the toxic narrative that African American women are forced into. I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, All Black Girls Are Activists, with the Ebony Janice Moore, In Black America.
It's basically saying, we deserve freedom now. We need to stop waiting for some elusive future, this Afrofuturistic idea of even the ways that we, excuse me, from a Southern Black Christian perspective, heaven as a way to just hopeful that one day we'll be free. And we lean into that by saying, if we don't experience it here in this body, we'll experience heaven in heaven. All the black girls are actively in this body right now, right here. This very worthy body that God has designed us, desired for us, and willed for us to be free now and experience that. So, like I said, it's a love letter to black women saying that we've already been doing more important work. We deserve to be celebrated for that. And at the same time, we don't have to die, to make that reality. We have died enough.
African American women have historically been at the forefront of social justice movements, advocating for change and progress in their communities. Ebony Janice Moore is a transformational speaker, a passionate multi-faith preacher. She believed African American women have been stereotyped far too long. The core and center of her work is the professional and personal restoration of African American women. As a child growing up in Northeast Ohio, more Southern black Christian values lend themselves to activism. In a book, All Black Girls Are Activists, who would black women get to be if they got to create from a place of dreaming instead of always having to create from resistance? Recently in Black America spoke Ebony Janice Moore.
Traditional and very conservative sometimes, even as liberal as I find myself to be, and all of those ways say I'm deeply enmeshed in a civil rights, black-centric, upbringing because of the fact that my elders were deeply invested in those realities from their upbringing. And super predominantly white space, Kentucky, Ohio, at this point I was born in the
Our child growing up in Detroit, we used to go to Sandusky for the music park here. So I am very familiar with that. See the point? Yeah, I am very familiar with that area.
I have never heard about the major in which you received your bachelor's in.
Cultural anthropology. Talk to us about that.
My undergraduate degree was in culture and anthropology, or one of my undergraduate degrees in culture and anthropology, which basically is the study of the human condition from a cultural perspective, like focusing on culture and how culture impacts our humanity. It's the simplest way that I can explain it.
And the master's in social change, the concentration in spiritual leadership,
right.
Womanist theology, and racial justice. Talk to us about those.
Now that's made up, but that's a real thing too. but yes, I have a master's of art in social change and the emphasis on spiritual and religious leadership. And I focus my studies on womanist theology and racial justice.
My very unique experience as a black woman. And so they
decided to name themselves woman, even though Alice Walker wasn't necessarily thinking from a Christian perspective, but these Black Christian religious scholars decided to name themselves a woman as because of the definition of woman. So in alignment with what the work that they wanted to do, they wanted to center Black women's wholeness, and that felt impossible to do without spirituality and adjustment from a defense perspective. So they called themselves woman and theologian. I obviously years later took on the name of myself, particularly after I got through my master's degree program, and I had so much on woman theology and my studies, to name myself a hip hop woman, and I am another generation who was raised simultaneously by the church, by activism, and by hip hop. So that is a very, 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 the Free People Project was birthed out of a broken heart. I was deeply depressed, and that depression was so thick that it had me questioning what my actual purpose was on this planet. And I feel like God gave me very clear messaging that I was called to minister to the brokenhearted, to empower people into truth, and to remind us of our capacity to do all things. And the Free People Project became really my ministry, even though the focus very often as of late can feel very justice-centered. I know that God loves justice, so I still consider it my ministry from the thrust of it, but I founded it really to be thinking about those things, to be thinking about what does it mean to exist inside of our fullness, inside of our purpose, inside of our wholeness, and to do good in the world, you know, to be thinking about liberation for all people, to be co-creating a just and equitable society together, and to do it and to be well while doing it. I don't want to sacrifice my life, my health, my vision, my joy, or my happiness. I want to consider an act of wisdom that God desires for me, that I am well, and I'm a fuller version of myself, a more fuller version of myself for my people.
So how does the Ebony Tiny Project augment the Free People Project?
The Ebony Tiny Project is just thinking about me exclusively. That's the idea in conversation, really supplemental to what the Free People Project has become. But it was really years into the Free People Project taking that step back and saying, oh, there is an actual revolutionary work that is necessary inside of my personal life. And before I can be the best preacher, teacher, coach, friend, mentor to anybody else, Ebony needs herself to be liberated, to be set free, to be actually whole. So it works simultaneously, a lot of the programs, and sometimes, you know, a lot over, but the Ebony Project is really about me and the rest of y'all just get the benefit from the case.
This is Black America. We'll be back with more of our conversation in a moment. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny Johnson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Ebony Janice Moore, founder and CEO of the Free People Project. And the Ebony Janice Project, an author of All Black Girls Are Activists, A Fourth Way in Women's Pursuit of Dreams as Radical Resistance. Ms. Moore, talk to us about All Black Girls Are Activists.
Yeah, this book, All Black Girls Are Activists, comes out July 11th, 2020, everywhere books are sold. I decided to write All the Black Girls Are Activists a little bit, just because at this point I decided to take a step back in my publishing work with the Free People Project, and I worked that I was doing around integration and education. And I was thinking about how Black women so often have to create from a place of resistance and not from our dreaming, and I wanted to think about what is my imagination. Because so much, you just hear me from the beginning of this conversation talking about liberation, talking about justice, talking about holding, talking about getting my people free, talking about being well, and that is so much of that. really angry from resist, like what people never said. I think it's kind of like entire, like so much of what we create is because we are sick and tired of being sick and tired. And the reality is, when I really got my stuff on myself, that felt very unfair to me. That if everything I was creating was from that place and not from this very needed version of myself, this wrong version of myself, version of myself that knows that she is well, that she is taken care of. You know, those are two different people. Those are two different people creating two different things, two different ideas of reality. So I thought I wanted to start taking on board that, you know, what would my life actually be, you know, if I centered my dream as a part of my resistance work and not just resistance. And the more I pressed into that and really started to study, with this womanist movement, I talked a little bit about world and earlier, they're considered, prior to this book, a third wave of womanism, meaning there might be some generations.
Black people, but especially with black men that I
that black men were creating a space for me to be vulnerable. That I knew that they would make sure that I was safe and that I was well and that I was taken care of. And that time period for me was so transformative that I started asking questions of my peer group as a cultural anthropologist is known to do, right? Thinking from a larger perspective, how are my black female friends experiencing soft man and so much of the stereotype or the stories that have been made on feet have been preventing so many of us from being able to walk over into or to lean over onto soft men. So the pursuit of soft men really is this: what if doing a space where I can be soft and be vulnerable, and also co-creating other black women, right? That I'm also calling black men into, a certain level of really in this. What does it look like for us to co-create a reality where black women can be soft and be vulnerable and know that we'll be taken care of and know that we'll be well and know that we'll be safe? And I'm considering that a part of our radical religion as well, because when we co-create that space, we erase the need for black people, black women to be seen in all of their racial tropes and ideas. Dr. Sonic Walker-Barr says that we are more often black women who happen to be strong versus this one word, strong black women. And so I'm going to create space inside the conversation I saw. What does it look like for us to hold on to the reality that we are black women, happy and strong, that we are not just strong black women, and how can we, especially black people, co-create that space together?
As an African-American yourself and myself understand the power of black women, over the years and generations, there have been the bedrock of culture. How will your book emphasize that strength going forward?
Oh yeah. All the black girls are actively love letters to black girls saying that we have done so much. Saying that this current iteration, in fact, across there is no movement for justice that has not included the foundational work of black women's resistance work. That in fact black women were some of the first people who were organizing inside of slavery here on this continent. We don't know anything about liberation, freedom, work without the deep emotional work of black women.
Talk to us about Black Girl Mixtape.
Black Girl Mixtape is a multi-platform think space that I created several years ago. world because I was experiencing something around another well-known lecture series that I won't say the name of. I mean, it's kind of one well-known lecture. And I'm thinking about the fact that I had seen so many viral videos from the workshop, and talking about these people get up there and talk from a place of authority, and it boggled my mind that I've never saw any viral videos at that point of black women. So I'm asking the question, where are the black women speaking on authority from various topics in these various industries? And so black women made work from that idea that I wanted to create space, intellectual and creative space where black women got to be centered at the authority.
Project and author of All Black Girls Are Activists. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future in Black America problems, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez,
I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr.
Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas 78712. That's In Black America CDs. KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
Thanks for listening to In Black America, KUT Radio, In Black America, members of the NPR Network, and the Independent Coalition of Public Media Podcasters. Find more shows on the network on your favorite podcast platform. I'm Johnny L. Henson, Jr.
Thank you.
Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we broadcast our crucial recent interview with Australian journalist John Pilger.
I would say he's a great journalist, probably the best journalist in the world. We're talking about the coming war with China. No question, it would be more crucial to us to listen.
We also speak with Andrew Paris, senior editor of The Lever on autocracy, Democratic and Republican parties, climate change.
Andrew raises Obama's legacy on the climate crisis as just one example.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
Today, we're rebroadcasting a recent interview we did with the great Australian journalist John Pilger called The Coming War in China. With the exception of a short break at the conclusion in 1975 of the Vietnamese War, the United States has been at war continually. The momentum, what President Dwight Eisenhower warned us against and described as being led by the military-industrial complex, has been going on successive wars against Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and now the American proxy war in Ukraine. The military-industrial complex has been augmented by support by CIA, Congress, both parties, and the corporate media. As Pilger demonstrates, the United States is building up for war against China. This build-up is both military and ideological, shaped by hostile propaganda. In this respect, an alarming full-page New York Times article, 11 weeks in the making, and written by seven reporters, appeared on August 5th. The article targeted the American peace organization Code Pink, as well as one of its financial backers. It's a hit piece that has alarmed many of us in the movement. John Pilger gives us the background to it. Give a listen.
Today we speak with 83-year-old renowned journalist, author, and documentary filmmaker John Pilger from his home in Australia about his most recent article, The Coming War with China. Is China a threat? Is the fear that is being stirred up about China legitimate? China has the second largest economy in the world. It will soon be the first. In response to China's commercial threat, the United States has responded militarily by surrounding the Chinese industrial heartland with 400 bases in what has been called a noose. The U.S. has some 1,100 bases around the world, while China has six. President Obama initiated a multi-trillion dollar vast nuclear buildup. This was coordinated with what he termed a pivot towards Asia. Most of the U.S. Navy now patrols the waters off China. Tensions have been exacerbated with respect to who governs Taiwan. The U.S. government shored up its military alliances with China's neighboring countries, such as South Korea, Japan, the Philippines, and Australia. And the U.S. is selling billions of dollars worth of nuclear submarines to Australia. We in the U.S. live